From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As we end the year 2019, today we'll reflect on the biggest international stories of the year. One of the most dispiriting aspects of this past year was how right-wing dictators took hold of their constituencies, consolidated power, and boosted one another across borders. But equally inspiring were the people-powered movements that shut down cities, demanded change, and in many cases altered the course of their nations. Movements like those in Hong Kong, in Sudan, in Lebanon, and elsewhere. My guest is John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He's a regular writer for Tom Dispatch, and he's also the author of a new IPS report called The Battle for Another World, The Progressive Response to the New Right. Welcome to the program, John.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So I want to say at the outset that, of course, we're not going to be able to touch on all the stories worth covering in 2019 on the international stage. We probably won't even come close. I know for those members of our audience, you might want me to touch on, you know, your favorite issue. It may not come up. We may not get to it. But we're going to try our best in the short time that we have. And I feel like in terms of what I started out discussing, which is that right-wing leaders, many of them, but not all, democratically elected, managed to consolidate their power. I'm thinking of not just Trump here in the US, but of course, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Narendra Modi in India, dictatorial figures like that. Overall, would you say there's been a right-wing surge in leadership in democracies?
Absolutely. And as you said, it's not just the electoral victories, because, of course, Trump won in 2016, so it's already some time ago, but the consolidation of their power and the promotion of their agendas. To give you an example, Boris Johnson in England, people really didn't think he was going to achieve much of anything. He's kind of a clown. But in fact, he went for a very risky option of calling an early election in Britain and has managed to get a commanding majority in the UK Parliament and will be pushing through Brexit by the end of January. So that's a pretty remarkable transformation right there.
You also saw the undermining of some left-leaning governments. Bolivia is one that comes to mind pretty strongly, where Evo Morales was essentially forced out of power. That too ought to be seen as a trend in a disturbing direction, with him being replaced by a new right leader, and of course that the leadership in that country in general being in disarray.
Yeah, I mean, here you have a leader who is quite popular and who, you know, not only won the election, but even if it had been redone, probably would have won a re-election or a second election, and undermined, unfortunately, by a combination of forces within the country, as well as a kind of report from the OAS on the legitimacy of the election that had taken place. In stark contrast, for instance, the impeachment in South Korea, which happened a couple years ago, where you had an extraordinarily unpopular leader and an impeachment process, which was widely seen as legitimate. So in the Bolivian case, yes, definitely a kind of coup-like maneuver on the part of right-wing forces in the country.
And then we know that India is trending right now near the end of the year with the Hindu nationalist government of Narendra Modi pushing through an Islamophobic law that seems to have broken the camel's back, if you will, with triggering of these mass protests around the country. And Modi, who sees himself aligned with the Bolsonaros and Trumps of the world, again, is a person who came to power through an election in a secular democracy. Do you feel, and I know some people are writing about this, that right-wing dictatorial figures are effectively taking advantage of democratic processes, electoral processes, very effectively, much more so than the left imagined?
Yes, and you know, the Indian case is a kind of intersection of two trends. One is a kind of Islamophobic network that connects a number of different countries around the world, India, Israel, Hungary, as well as a number of Buddhist countries like Myanmar, Thailand, Sri Lanka, all of them kind of connected both formally and informally in their Islamophobic project. And then the other trend is kind of a redefinition of citizenship, which intersects in many cases with the Islamophobic project, but is a majoritarian impulse, an impulse by the majority, which is elected in through democratic elections, a populist, often right-wing populist leader, to redefine citizenship, to make it much more difficult for minorities to find a home in those countries. The primary examples would be, as you said, India, but also we saw a new citizenship law in Israel as well. And there's a push by the European far right to do the same thing. So it's a very troubling trend that's crescendoing. That crescendoed in 2019.
And I suppose we should see, speaking of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu among those right-wing dictatorial leaders coming to power repeatedly through democratic means, except right near the end of this year when he was indicted on charges of bribery, and suddenly his leadership is coming into question. And one sort of can't help but draw some comparison with Trump's impeachment, that some of these figures remain in power, but precariously.
Yes, and you know, this is a trend of these leaders, many of them right wing, even though they, you know, decry corruption, they promise to drain the swamp, they're extraordinarily vulnerable on this question because they are highly corrupt themselves. Trump, of course, is being impeached not specifically for corruption per se, although there are a number of people in the United States who would like to levy the corruption charge against him, for instance, around the emoluments issue. But we see it with a number of other leaders, Netanyahu, you mentioned, Putin in Russia as well, very vulnerable on the corruption issue. Basically,
and thank you for bringing up Putin. I can't forget to include him in the club of right-wing dictators that are in power in democracies.
Absolutely. And he, too, is, you know, trying to maneuver. He's in power until 2024, I believe. But he's maneuvering now for potentially to change the Constitution so that he can argue he can run again one more time, even though there actually are term limits in the current Russian constitution.
So let's talk about the people power aspect of these, of the global trend. There was a time when it seemed like, you know, 20 different people-powered movements were destabilizing cities across the world, and it was quite remarkable. It feels like one that has gotten the most attention, perhaps because it has been so consistent and seems to not be tiring out, is the battle for Hong Kong, with Hong Kong's residents having brought their country, their city, their region that is part of China, but not really, to a standstill for so many months. That feels like the majority of the year, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And this is mostly young people, a generation of folks who feel as if, you know, the freedoms, the human rights that they expected as part of their birthright in Hong Kong are gradually being taken away from them. As your listeners will know, Hong Kong was handed over to China, mainland China, in 1997, with a 50-year period of time during which Hong Kong and China would be basically one country in two systems. And the Hong Kong system would be very different politically and economically. But the folks in Hong Kong, and particularly the younger generation, feel as if this different system is no longer being tolerated, and it's a kind of a death by a thousand cuts by mainland. But it's not just that. It's also a frustration that for young people, they have difficulties finding jobs and difficulties finding places to live in Hong Kong, and the gap, the economic gap between rich and poor in this relatively small area is enormous. So these two things collide politically and economically to produce these long-standing protests.
A big critique of the Hong Kong protests from some sectors of at least the American left was that it seemed that the protests were taken advantage of by forces in the U.S. that would like to see China as an enemy, that there were some aspects of the Hong Kong protests that were very pro-U.S., even pro-Trump. And you have seen that as a critique of other people-powered movements elsewhere, where funding from agencies like the U.S. Agency for Development, USAID, is sometimes discovered and sometimes seen as undermining those movements. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that has been a legitimate criticism in the past, and we can talk about it in particular context. But certainly under Trump, the ability of the U.S. government or the interest from the Trump administration to engage in that kind of soft power transformation has declined precipitously. The State Department has seen a tremendous loss in personnel and funding. Trump himself has basically said he doesn't really care about human rights. He has, you know, sided in many cases with Xi Jinping on the Hong Kong protests, even calling them a riot. Although, of course, recently he also signed legislation, two pieces of legislation from Congress, bipartisan pieces that would subject Chinese and Hong Kong leadership to sanctions if they engage in gross human rights violations. But nonetheless, I would say that at this point in time, the United States is probably paying the least amount of attention to that kind of influencing. But I would say, however, that in general, there is a kind of a tightening, if you will, or an escalation in anti-Chinese rhetoric coming from Washington, irrespective of Hong Kong, around trade issues, intellectual property rights. And there is increasingly a congressional consensus that the United States has not been hard enough in its negotiating with mainland China. So that is certainly true.
And of course, there was a lot of China bashing at the recent Democratic debate as well. Seemed like it took up a disproportionate amount of time. Let's turn to the Middle East, which of course has been the center of U.S. foreign policy for so long. It seemed like one of the biggest stories in the Middle East of 2019 was the ongoing tussle between the U.S. and, or some parts of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia over the murder of Jamal al-Khashoggi, the Saudi dissident journalist who was a writer for the Washington Post and who we just found out in whose name Saudi Arabia has just sentenced five people to death. We don't know if those are sacrificial lambs or really people involved in the killing, but we do know, and even the U.S. intelligence services know, that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, the killing of Khashoggi goes all the way up to him. What do you make of U.S.-Saudi relations in light of this killing as it played out in 2019? Didn't seem like Khashoggi's gruesome death made much of a difference in practical terms, or did it?
Well, it made no difference, certainly in terms of the Trump administration. I mean, Donald Trump has basically gone all in with Saudi Arabia, has seen Mohammed bin Salman as kind of the chief partner for U.S. policy in the region, really expected Saudi Arabia to step up to the plate in the deal for Palestine, providing all the resources that the Trump administration expected the Palestinians to accept in exchange for basically stepping back from their territorial or sovereignty claims. And Saudi Arabia, of course, figures very prominently in the Trump administration's desire to push down Iran as much as possible. Obviously, it unraveled the nuclear deal with Iran, has kind of put in a full court press in terms of economic sanctions, and has sided with Saudi Arabia at every point along the way. But that's the Trump administration. Congress has taken a somewhat different attitude. Congress, even Republicans, expressed horror at the Khashoggi killing. For the first time, Congress really, in a bipartisan way, expressed considerable discontent for U.S. support of Saudi Arabia in the ongoing war in Yemen. So there is this bifurcation that has really started to to emerge between the Trump administration and its Republican colleagues in Congress. However, the impeachment question has kind of pushed in the opposite direction. In other words, has created a kind of consolidating influence among Republicans.
There's the protests in Iraq as well, which were huge, remain quite big. The government crackdown has been big. They haven't received as much attention here in the U.S. as perhaps they deserved. Do you see these protests facing Iraq as a direct outcome of the meddlesome role that the U.S. played as it fought its war in Iraq and then, you know, set up a system that seemed destined to fail as it exited Iraq?
Well, obviously, anything that happens today in Iraq is going to be the consequence of U.S. Invasion and attempt at nation building, or nation rebuilding, if you will, in Iraq. But I would also connect what happens in Iraq to what's going on elsewhere around the world, these kind of anti-austerity protests that have been taking place.
Lebanon.
Exactly. Throughout Central and South America. In other words, economic globalization and the polarization that continues to apace with economic globalization is hitting people very, very hard. And I think that in some countries, they expected there would be a political solution. In other words, you know, a populist leader would come in with promises, and that has turned out not to be particularly effective.
There's also the issue of the U.S. Pulling out its troops from supporting Kurds in Syria, in northern Syria, with Turkey moving in. The Syria war continues, there was supposed to be a peace process that was being hosted with actors such as Russia and Iran, who have all played a destructive role in Syria. And I'm wondering, that war in Syria, which the U.S. played a role in, but was really a war by dictator Bashar al-Assad against his own people, as other multiple competing aspects were playing out. That war in Syria had generated the most deaths over the last few years, the most misery, the most destruction. In 2019, what became of Syria?
Yes, well, with the defeat, more or less, of the Islamic State, of ISIS, and the renewed or even accelerated support of both Russia and Iran, Bashar al-Assad could basically consolidate his control over pretty much all of the country. The one remaining section, of course, was the northern Kurdish-controlled region. And this he had his eye on, but of course also Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Turkish leader, had his eye on it as well, in part because Erdogan was arguing that Kurdish separatists were kind of being supported by the Syrian Kurds over the border, and he wanted to eliminate, sever that connection. Trump waded into that in a way that was not helpful. I mean, he didn't really understand the situation. He was eager to curry favor with Erdogan. And so he basically gave the green light to the Turks to have cross-border raids. So at the moment, you know, it's unclear what will happen in terms of the marginal Kurdish sovereignty. The Kurds basically have aligned themselves with Assad in order to beat back the Turks. We've seen, of course, some indications that ISIS, or the Islamic State, will be able to profit from this situation and regroup. But, the consequences of this, what seemed to be a relatively simple green light from Trump, I think will be calamitous going into 2020.
We're not going to get to all of the stories I want to get to, because I want to move quickly to your report. But I just want to mention, of course, the country where the U.S. has fought the longest war in official history, Afghanistan. Violence has spiked, more civilians being killed. There were new revelations in the Washington Post with the Afghanistan papers showing that officials for years lied about the progress in the war. Iran protests have continued. There have been a very violent crackdown by the government, resulting in dozens being killed. Lebanon had a success story over several weeks of sustained protests. They toppled their leader. There's a new prime minister. Sudan had a similar story where a longtime dictator was overturned, and would be very interesting to see what happens in 2020 in Sudan. Let's talk about another The Battle for Another World, the Progressive Response to the New Right, which is a report that IPS put out, written by you. And you touched on it a little earlier, which is this issue of austerity. And this is an aspect that is so critical when we talk about international stories, which is a global financial system, which has had a changing landscape over several years. This year saw the demise of the World Trade Organization, which ought to have been a massive left-wing victory, but actually it was something that the right claimed credit for. Tell me a little bit about this report and how global inequality, the World Trade Organization, and all play into it.
Sure. Well, starting from kind of the point of economic globalization, you know, even the World Bank and the IMF were agreeing over the last couple of years that the economic progress that has happened as a result of economic globalization has only benefited a small group of people in the world, billionaires, trillionaires, and the larger mass of people have not benefited from globalization, especially if you take out kind of China from the equation. And obviously, China's entrance into the global economy did benefit a large number of Chinese who rose above the poverty level. But if you take China out of the picture, you have a great amount of discontent. Now, as you said, with respect to the World Trade Organization, the left could have stepped in or should have stepped in and said, well, here's our program. Here's our alternative to economic globalization as it's been conceived of, and benefited at the polls. We should have seen after the 2008-2009 financial crisis a real swing leftward, and we did see some movement left to a certain extent in the United States, to a certain extent in Latin America. But more recently, we've seen just a tremendous move to the right. And you can find very few left or even left liberal governments in the world any longer outside of New Zealand or Iceland. So the right has benefited, had profited by making the argument that they will put forward economic programs that will benefit those who have been left behind by economic globalization. And you see this throughout Europe, where the far right has succeeded in Hungary, in Poland, in Italy, in Austria. But you see it as well throughout the global south. And it's not necessarily right-wing populist, but it could be people like Duterte in the Philippines, where it's not exactly clear whether he's left or right or simply just populist. So this, I think, is one of the major reasons why the right has been successful. But there are other reasons as well. The immigration question, the issue of racism and Islamophobia. The far right has made a platform that has kind of cut through a lot of the noise of social media and appealed to people, sometimes for the worst possible reason.
Well, finally, one of the biggest and most inspiring stories of 2019 was around the issue of climate. Although we had a failed COP25 meeting in Madrid, Spain recently, where not much was achieved, you also saw 2019 as the year of the school climate strikes, the Fridays for Future movement led by Greta Thunberg and echoed by young people around the world. And you also had the rise of this idea of a Green New Deal that could battle both the threat to the planet from climate change and the economic inequality that we are seeing. Is that an issue that your report suggests we really need to place more focus on?
Absolutely, because this is the issue that I think the global right is very weak. It either denies that there is a problem, or it has a kind of Band-Aid approach, and the worst kind of Band-Aid approach. Build higher walls to prevent the rising tide of climate refugees from overwhelming mostly the global north. So because they're particularly vulnerable on this issue, I think this is something that progressives can seize on. And the Green New Deal, both within countries, within the United States, within the European Union, but also a global Green New Deal can be very effective. But the latter has to include some kind of massive resource transfer between the North to the global South to enable the global South to really continue to develop in a sustainable manner. If without that kind of resource transfer, you're not going to get the global South on board for a global Green New Deal.
John, where can people find the link to the new report?
So they can go to the IPS website, which is ips-dc.org.
And we'll also place a direct link to that from our website. Thank you so much for joining us. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to you as well.
My guest is John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. He's the author of a new IPS report called The Battle for Another World, The Progressive Response to the New Right. We've been discussing the biggest international stories of 2019 in addition to the report. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.